We're pleased to have back here on the program this morning Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician from Carl Clinic. And every other month on the program here, oh, it's always on Monday, we do this show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is if you have general kinds of health care questions, can be for yourself, can be for your children, because he indeed sees people of all ages in his practice, you can call us. And I know that he will do his best to help you out. Anytime we do health programs, I try to remind people that we cannot diagnose over the phone. There are some limits to what we can do. So I hope you keep that in mind. But I don't want to discourage people from calling. Just let you know that there's a certain point at which if you have a real health concern, you're going to need to find someone who can actually see you rather than do this over the telephone. But this is a good place to start. If you have questions about health and healthcare, you can call in and talk to Dr. Jeff, and he will do his best. As I say, he'll do his best to give you an answer. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Good morning, David. I'm glad to be back.
We have a caller already, so we will not make them wait, and we'll talk with them right away. In Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. I have a 6-year-old who is healthy as a horse. He's growing, gaining weight, very active, bright eyes, but he gets sick every 2 months. He gets a fever, he gets a sore throat, he gets a stiff neck, not meningitis, tough neck, but just, I think, related to the fever and the headache. Now, you know, friends, neighbors, relatives all say, oh, you should have that boy checked. There's something wrong with that kid. Well, I did mention it to the doctor, the pediatrician, once, and he said, well, look, he gets over them, doesn't he? Look at how hale and hearty he is. They have occasionally done a strep throat on him. Sometimes they've been positive, sometimes they've been negative. Any ideas what else? And actually, the last time I took him in was about 2 months ago when he was sick. He had been very sick for 4 days with a fever, 103, 104, 104.5. And it had been 4 full days by then. She said, if he's still sick tomorrow, bring him in and I'll do blood work on him. Now, he's sick again right now. This is day 4. He was 104.3 on Saturday. Any ideas what kind of blood work they would do and whether there is truly a need to do anything?
As a general rule, the fact that the episodes do indeed resolve and he apparently is healthy in between times is a very reassuring piece of information.
Right.
The situation where somebody has recurrent fevers, isn't doing well, looks poorly, loses weight, you know, is sort of declining, would be much more concerning.
Right.
At this age, generally, exposure to other infectious disease occurs in the school setting.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of these are viral, and unfortunately, you then don't develop necessarily absolute immunity, and there are a large number of different types of viruses that certainly make the rounds, and being re-exposed won't prevent you from getting it again just because you had it 2 months ago.
Right.
Now, it is reasonable to try and exclude certain types of bacterial infections because those will often get better sooner with antibiotics. Viral infections generally have to run their course. And it's appropriate, you know, if one of the significant symptoms is sore throat, to check for strep, especially in the winter when it's more common.
Uh-huh.
The laboratory work that you referred to most generally initially would be what's called a CBC, or complete blood count. You can measure someone's hemoglobin or red blood cell count, whether they're anemic or not. And you can also measure the white blood cell count, the types of cells in our bloodstream that help fight infection. There's often a fairly characteristic type of white blood cells seen with bacterial infections versus viral infections. So they may simply be suggesting a check to make sure that there are no other signs of either abnormality in the immune system, making sure that there are the right number of white blood cell counts, and also checking to see if there's an indication as to whether this might be a viral or bacterial process.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm quite happy to do nothing. My feeling is he is so healthy, he's so busy, that, yeah, he's just one of those kids that responds this way to exposure to, I'm presuming, viral illnesses. However, is there anything bacterial or viral that could remain in his body and rear its head every couple of months like this?
Generally speaking, no.
Okay.
So that would be, you know, very, very unusual, and again, wouldn't necessarily be seen in someone who otherwise looks totally well in between their episodes.
Mm-hmm. The puzzling thing about it is that none of the rest of the family ever gets sick when he is sick.
Count your blessings.
And he, I mean, I don't keep a record of it on the calendar. I should be, but I swear he is sick every 2 months. I usually don't take him to the doctor. I just happen to be a nurse myself, so I feel comfortable that I can tell that he's well hydrated and that he's urinating. So I don't really worry about it, but it's just, you know, friends, neighbors, mother.
And if it runs its course in a few days and he gets well, I think that's probably fine. In a situation where the temperature remains persistently elevated and it's been more than a few days, then I think it's probably reasonable to go check and see if there's something else going on.
Right. And I think the pediatrician is so used to seeing me that, you know, the general rule of 72 hours, bring them in.
Mm-hmm.
They see him after 72 hours and say, oh, yeah, he's got a viral illness. Well, I don't take him in after 72 hours anymore because I don't really want to expose him to any more germs in the doctor's office.
And there are plenty there.
As long as he's hydrated, you know, and as long as I don't see, you know, a septic arthritis or something else, I'm just going to keep him home and take care of him.
I don't think that's inappropriate at all.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Right, thank you for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just can we talk a little bit generally about fever?
Sure.
And particularly this question of at what point do you get concerned enough so that you want to take your child to the doctor?
Well, let's talk about the general topic of fever, because this will apply to both adults and children. Fever is a natural response. It is part of your body's immune system. It's part of the process of fighting off infection, whether it be viral or bacterial. And in a number of studies, it's been shown that you do not have to lower somebody's temperature back to normal with, you know, large quantities of ibuprofen or acetaminophen. And in fact, a low-grade fever may indeed be helpful in fighting off the infection. So totally suppressing it is not something that has to be done. Now, if your temperature is very high, you don't feel very good, and lowering it a degree or two may make you indeed feel better. And there's nothing wrong with that. Children have a very brisk immune response, and they will often generate fairly high fevers fairly quickly. They also tend to come down a little bit more quickly than adults. And you can't automatically state that a high fever is due to a bacterial or a viral process. But on a statistical basis, the vast majority of infectious diseases that we come in contact with are indeed viral. And if the temperature is not excessively high, and here's a situation where we get into concerns with parents, they're concerned that their children, as a result of a high fever, are going to have a seizure. It's going to cause brain damage. It's going to be in some way permanently harmful. And there are indeed children who have febrile seizures. It doesn't seem to be associated with any type of permanent neurological problem. But there are situations where you can indeed raise a temperature so high that it does cause problems. But as a general rule, we're talking about temperatures in the 106, 107 degree range for a prolonged period of time. So even if you have a temperature of 102, 103, 104, you don't feel good, but it's highly unlikely that it's going to cause any permanent long-lasting damage. when you do have a high temperature, you're much kind of like the radiator in your car. When it's getting warm, you need to put some more fluid in there. And for children, especially, avoiding dehydration when fever is present is important. And lots of fluids, some acetaminophen, ibuprofen, lukewarm sponge baths. There are a number of things that you can do to lower the temperature, make somebody more comfortable, but it is not necessary to drive it back down to 98.6. So at this point, in this time of year, some fever in and of itself may indeed be a sign that you need to look for other symptoms of illness, but in and of itself doesn't necessarily mean anything terrible.
Okay. Well, again, other questions are welcome. If you'd like to talk with Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he's a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic. He's here with us once a month. It's always on a Monday. Pardon me, not once a month. He's not here every other month. He's on a little longer the rotation than some of the folks that we have as regular. So every other month. If you have questions, you can call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I thought it would be appropriate for us to talk a little bit about the flu, as now it's beginning to look like that it could be, we could have a bad flu season this year. Could be particularly bad. Question number one: If one did indeed get a flu shot, there seems to be some question about, and you know, we've talked about this in the past, that when they make up the flu vaccine, they look out there in the world and kind of look at what kind of flu is going around and make their best guess as to which of the many different varieties of virus people might come in contact with, because they can't, you know, there's only so much they can put into the shot. So they make their guess, they put it in the shot. It looks like this time around, maybe the nasty bug that's going around, it wasn't in this shot. Is that, I got that right?
Some of the reported cases of influenza type A right now are of a variety that is not represented specifically in the flu shot. The reason why you can't get a flu shot once and be protected forever is the fact that the flu virus itself mutates on a regular basis and genetically becomes different. And this accounts for situations like right now, where they either didn't pick the strain that they thought was going to be most popular, or in fact the virus, by the time it got here, has indeed mutated, because there's obviously a lag time of, you know, 4 to 6 months in terms of preparing the vaccine, producing it, distributing it, giving it to people, and during that time frame the virus also mutates. So right now there are indeed reported cases of influenza type A that are not represented in the flu shot. That doesn't mean necessarily that your flu shot won't be protective, because there is some cross-reactivity between the various viruses, but it's not going to be as completely protective as had they had the exact type of genetic material to work with.
So it sounds as if you encountered this strain that was not included in the vaccine, it's possible you might get sick still, but maybe not quite as bad.
Right.
So you're still better. You're still ahead of having gotten the shot.
Correct. And the other flu viruses in the vaccine are still protective as well. There are indeed more than one type of flu virus. Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out, they try to hit the major ones that are most likely to be a problem. But even in the presence of, flu shots, every few years you run into a situation where there's just a really big outbreak of influenza, and it's primarily because of viral mutation and being unable to adequately protect against something that essentially is relatively new. The community here, I think, is doing a very good job of, getting out the word regarding the benefits of flu shots, and also trying to emphasize the potential benefits of immunizing even otherwise well individuals. I think it's pretty well understood that folks over the age of 65, folks with chronic heart and lung disease, definitely should be getting a flu shot. But even otherwise healthy individuals, if immunized, can significantly reduce the amount of flu that's then going around the community. And there was a bigger push this year to immunize children because one of the biggest places where the flu gets spread is in the school system.
We can talk a little bit more about this, particularly about what if now you've decided that maybe you didn't get the shot and you would like to, what do you do? Because there's no more vaccine left.
The flu vaccine supply is actually quite limited right now. I know at Carl they ordered, I believe, 50,000 doses, which was 6,000 more than they had ordered last year, and they've virtually used all of it and are still experiencing demand for the vaccine.
Okay. Well, we can talk some more about these things. I have a couple callers, and particularly I have somebody who's on a cell phone, so I want to get to them. We'll take them next, and that's line number one.
Hi.
Hello.
Would you go back to something you said when you first came on about viruses being able to get them over and over again, the same virus, not necessarily being immune once you've gotten something? And it's always been my understanding that once you've had a virus, you develop immunity and you're not going to get that particular virus again. In other words, if you have a cold, you give it to your sister's not going to give it back to you, that you acquire immunity, and you're confusing me. Would you address that, please?
There is a brief period of not necessarily long-lasting immunity, but when you've had your cold, you have mobilized all of your immune responses to try and suppress that. So it's highly unlikely that you're going to turn around and get it, you know, next week, simply because you've activated your immune response to fight it off. But 2 years later, there is no long-lasting immunity to that virus. And the other problem is such with the cold virus, there's probably 200 or 300 variations on a theme in terms of cold viruses. Short of doing very sophisticated virologic studies, it's going to be pretty hard to know that this cold virus isn't the same one as the one you had last year, but they are going to be quite similar. And you won't necessarily, just because you had a cold last year, be protected against getting a cold next year.
I understand different all the millions of viruses and can cause a cold. Is it the same with strep then? That's why you can keep getting strep over and over again, because there are so many very different strains of strep, being bacterial, I realize, but.
No, interestingly enough, the strep bacteria is generally the same, but your body doesn't produce a long-lasting immune response. The body's protection against infection is sort of a short-term response and also a long-term response. In terms of strep, yes, you can indeed fight off the infection, but it does not convey immunity. And indeed, if re-exposed to it, 2 months later, you can get it again.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. Let's go to another caller here. This is Chicago, line four. Hello.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Yes.
I was wondering, what was the immunity being affected by so many things in our environmental, as well as what we eat? But principally, sugar and alcohol seem to have been reported by health groups to, say, diminish your immunity for so many hours of the day. I was wondering if you had an observation or comment on that fact, and I have another question after that.
I guess I'm not aware of that as a fact, and consequently I don't have a comment.
Well, one point as an illustration, around Halloween when kids are out trick-or-treating and they get all the candy, the throats become so sticky from the taking in all the sweets, etc., and whatever floating around in the way of coughs and sneezes and bacteria, adhere to the stickiness on the one hand, and then it's been noted by alternative and complementary health groups that sugar is definitely contributing to the immune system being down for like 5-6 hours at least, depending on how much of your sugar you're taking in, and alcohol to some extent, depending how knocked out you get. But there is this observation that holds true on that. But my second question was, someone I know that's been unfortunately ridden with pain of different sorts for arthritic and other kind of conditions, uncertain at this point. A doctor simply wrote Celebrex, take this for your pain. Do you think that's a proper thing, or should they go through some rheumatologist or get some blood tests and so forth to work out to see what may be the real factor?
I think it's, as a general rule, always appropriate to take enough of a history, do enough of a physical exam, do what, if any, confirmatory lab or x-ray studies are necessary to establish a firm diagnosis before prescribing.
In so for the general areas of pain, suddenly they've come down with all things the last several months. It's not been stable, going up or down, but inflammation, I think, is a contributing factor, they say. And getting around to another point, these COX-2 or COX-1 and COX-2, as they were referred to, Celebrex is meant to inhibit the, you know, the process that causes the pain and inflammation. Is that what you understand also?
That's correct. Most of the, quote, arthritis medications are indeed anti-inflammatory agents. The process of inflammation in the joint is what's responsible for most of the pain. Most individuals obviously want relief of their pain. You can simply blunt the pain response with things like narcotics, or you can try and remove or suppress the underlying inflammation with anti-inflammatory agents. And the one of the mainstays of treatment of the pain associated with arthritis is the use of anti-inflammatory agents. Most people are familiar with aspirin and ibuprofen, and there are some newer medications, as you alluded to, that work by a slightly different mechanism. They are not necessarily better anti-inflammatory agents, but they do seem to be a little bit better tolerated from a gastrointestinal standpoint.
One more point, finally. I understand some groups have come out now with another blocker besides COX-1 and 2. There's another agent they found out has been like a channel for the pain to filter through, and they've come up with some new ways of blocking that, I understand. I don't know if you've heard about anything like that.
Well, there are indeed other types of medication, both oral and topical, that can be used to block the pain response. Some of these are not anti-inflammatory agents. Some of them actually are medications that target the nerve that carries the pain impulse. And as such, a number of these medications that block the nerve response have also been used as seizure medications.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. All right, we're about at our midpoint here in this part of Focus 580. It's the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician from Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month he is here. We open up the phone lines, and if there's something on your mind, some healthcare concern, if it's for you, it's for your children, that's fine. You can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Going back to the flu for just a few minutes more, maybe there are people who did not get a flu shot, but now have heard the news stories about the fact that it could be a bad flu season, and now they're thinking, gosh, I wish I had. Apparently, they're most, and it's not just here, I think it's just all over the place, there isn't much vaccine left. So if someone did not get the shot, but now is thinking, I'd really not rather not get the flu, is there some alternative for them?
Short of leaving the country.
Short of leaving the country, or just staying home and not going out until spring.
Okay. Yes. A new medication called FluMist is an inhaled nasal spray using a partially killed virus, and it is indeed capable of providing immunity to the flu, but it is only recommended for otherwise healthy individuals under the age of 65. It is potentially more problematic in that it is not using a killed virus, as is in the flu shot. You really can't get the flu from the flu shot because the virus is dead. And there are people who indeed react badly to injections, but you really shouldn't be getting the flu. The flu mist, however, uses only a partially killed virus, so there is some potential concern about disseminating at least a partially live virus from individual to individual. And consequently, folks who get the flu mist shouldn't be working in the healthcare arena where they come in contact with other individuals who are going to be sick. They should be staying away from other folks who have suppressed immunity, HIV patients, cancer patients, for fear of potentially transmitting this virus to others. That's actually been looked at. It's a rare occurrence, but it's not zero. The vaccine itself, in terms of the flu mist preparation, is significantly more expensive than a regular flu shot, but it has the potential of being able to immunize the large majority of otherwise healthy individuals, which would then hopefully free up the flu shot for higher risk groups, which are typically those over the age of 65 and those with chronic heart and lung disease.
Okay. Let me ask one more question, and then we got a couple of callers we'll get right to. For all of us, whether we got our flu shots or not, for people who want to do anything they can to stay healthy and not get the flu, in terms of prevention, what can we do?
You already mentioned it, which is don't come in contact with anybody else, which unfortunately during busy holiday season is extremely difficult to do. But in fact, there's probably some benefit to frequent hand washing. There's probably a benefit in crowded situations to a mask. And the key is to, if at all possible, to stay away from any other individual who's known to be ill.
Okay. And for how long, what's the period, what's the incubation period? How long before coming in contact and then showing symptoms?
Interestingly enough, a relatively short period of time, sometimes literally less than a day. But generally, if sufficiently exposed, you're probably going to come down with symptoms within 1 to 3 days.
All right. So the chances are, there is that chance, but if you definitely, if there's someone, a friend, family, someone who really says, I'm sick, I feel bad, you stay away from that person.
That's correct.
And chances are then that's, but, you know, that and the other thing. I'm getting to think we should seek some underwriting from some soap manufacturer for for as many times as we have people on the show and say, wash your hands. I think
it is still the number one method of preventing the transmission of infectious disease.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone in Champaign next, line one. Hello.
Hello. I have a six-year-old son who has had a rash for 5 days, and he hasn't shown any other symptoms until today, which is runny nose. And it's itchy, and the thing that concerns me most is his eyelids are pink and puffy. They seem to be kind of swollen. And so I don't know, like, what sort of illnesses could cause that. I mean, because it doesn't seem to be something viral, like he's not coughing, sneezing, all of that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, as David mentioned earlier, there are a few things that are really, really tough to do over the over the phone, and rashes are right up there because it is entirely based on what it looks like. I would literally be just sort of guessing off the top of my head, and I don't really want to do that because there really isn't any way I can accurately give you much feedback about you know, a problem associated with a rash. Mm-hmm. In children, what's referred to as a viral exanthem, which is a rash associated with a virus, is relatively common, but they do typically have the other, you know, viral cold type symptoms as well, low-grade fever, runny nose, sore throat, a little cough.
Okay.
But rashes can also be non-infectious. They can be related to things that perhaps you're allergic to,
mm-hmm.
and have come in contact with. So this is a situation where you really would have to have somebody look at the rash to be able to answer your question.
Okay. Is it something I should worry about because there aren't other symptoms? I mean, if it is an allergy-related thing, shouldn't it be going away soon?
It depends. If it's something that he continues to come in contact with, no, it's not going to go away.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. You know, Ann Tice does that all the time.
Diagnoses
rashes
over the phone.
Yeah, don't tell her I said that.
She's much better than I.
Next is Matt Toon, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Are there any options regarding prevention for someone who's allergic to eggs? I understand this flu mist is not in that category. And
it unfortunately, along with the flu shot, is, as part of the manufacturing process, produced in egg protein. And it is considered a relative contraindication if you have a significant egg allergy to then take either the flu shot or the nasal spray flu mist.
What would be, I think possibly you've covered some of this, but for someone over 65, what would be the immediate symptoms of this latest strain of flu?
Well, the typical influenza symptoms are usually the relatively acute. It's not something that sort of builds up over days or weeks, but I mean, people often say, you know, it was 4 o'clock on Thursday afternoon and all of a sudden I developed this relatively high fever. 102, 103 is not at all uncommon. Headache seems to be fairly common symptom. That diffuse, achy, you know, I got run over by a truck yesterday kind of feeling. Legs, low back, that what we call myalgia, that achy, sore, muscular feeling. And then, in addition, cough can become a fairly prominent symptom. But the initial symptoms are typically the high fever, headache, myalgias, and then the cough. And then people generally feel like really wiped out. A lot of times if you have just a cold, you feel irritated and annoyed that you have a cold, but you don't feel, you know, truly ill. Most people with influenza really feel ill and they feel pretty wiped out. The cough and some other minor sort of cold-like symptoms, runny nose, sore throat, can also be present, but it's really those first symptoms that we mentioned that really characterize influenza.
Well, if someone gets this, is there much they can do? Do they contact their doctor? Are there any over-the-counter medications that might lessen the
most of the over-the-counter medications are simply an attempt to treat symptoms, you know, things to bring down your temperature, things to make your muscles feel a little less sore, but there is no specific treatment for the viral illness available over the counter. There are a few prescription medications that can indeed be given to documented cases of influenza that are thought to shorten the length of time that the illness is active. But the degree of improvement there is, in many instances, pretty minimal. It might shorten your disease length by a day or two. In a few situations, there are some preventive, not necessarily preventive, but at least prophylactic medications that are given, say, like in nursing home settings. If there's an outbreak of influenza in a nursing home and there's close physical proximity of all the residents there, in many instances, medications like amantadine, which is prescribed for influenza, are given to the residents to try and minimize the spread of the outbreak. But in order to obtain any of those specific flu medications, yes, you would need to see your physician. And you would need to ideally see them fairly early in the course of the illness.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you. Again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You just, when you were talking just that last little bit about some prescription medications that can be used, you used the phrase a documented case.
Right.
So what do you do to make certain that it is indeed influenza the person has?
In the office or hospital setting, you can take a sample of the secretions from the nasal area or pharynx area and have the lab actually test it for the presence of the virus.
Oh, okay. So you culture it and grow it and see what comes out.
Right.
So that's
And this is often helpful early on in the flu season, because if we can identify that indeed the influenza virus is present in the community and is presenting with these sets of symptoms, after the first couple, you can usually say to the next person who comes in with those same set of symptoms, you probably have this type of influenza, and here's a type of medication that may be helpful. But it's also appropriate, you know, if somebody says, you know, I have fever and I have sore throat, it's appropriate to make sure they don't have strep throat, because their penicillin is quite appropriate, and viral medications aren't going to make any difference for a bacterial infection. There are a wide variety of just plain old colds that nothing is going to do much of anything for, and it's important to try as much as possible to separate those out so that you're not treating people inappropriately.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have another caller here. We'll talk with them. This is someone in Homer on line one. Hello.
Yes. I had a question this morning about, my daughter has a mass on her ovary, and she's going to have it removed. But at the present time, she's in a great deal of pain and is running a temperature. I just wondered if you could tell me anything about, in general, what might be going on. Would there be a chance that, just the irritation on that mass would be causing the fever?
How old is your daughter, ma'am?
35.
And other than knowing that it's just a mass, you don't have any other information about?
No, they have taken a sonogram, and their surgery scheduled, and it's about the size of a softball. She does not have, an infection. She had a urinalysis done, and there's no evidence that there's any.
A negative urinalysis would hopefully exclude infection in the urinary tract, which would be your urethra, bladder, kidneys, but it would not exclude an infection in the genital tract, the uterus, the tubes, the ovaries.
Okay.
So one potential possibility related to pain and fever, if it's due to the mass, is that she could potentially have an abscess, which would be a sort of a pocket of infectious material in the tuber or ovary.
Okay.
In most instances, there would be some clue to that from her blood count. Again, the white blood cell count is often elevated. And as a general rule, they would usually check for certain types of pelvic infections with some cultures. But in some instances, this may not be fully elucidated until the time of surgery, where, depending on what's seen, if it does indeed appear to be a pocket of infection, it can be drained and then cultured.
Okay.
But in addition to drainage, then some antibiotics would also be necessary.
Okay. I think she's going to be actually have some antibiotics before the surgery, but probably the fever and pain and so forth will not keep her from having the surgery.
If indeed they're part of the problem, the surgery actually should help that.
That's what we're thinking. It should be, hopefully will be part of the problem, but I thought, well, if you could shed any light on this, like, it's appreciated.
Okay.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you. We do have time for other questions. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic. He is with us every other month for this show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And we started doing it just because we thought it'd be good for people to have a regular opportunity to ask general kinds of health care questions. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. One of the earlier callers asked this question about what do you do if you have the allergy to eggs and you want to get the flu shot. And like, and that question has come up probably every time we've talked about it. And it seemed that the best we could do is say to them, make sure that everybody you know gets the flu
right.
shot.
And that's the concept, as we've discussed before, of herd immunity, mm-hmm. which is if you can get approximately 80% of the general population immunized against something, there's a fairly good chance that the unimmunized individual is then surrounded by immunized folks. Mm-hmm. And the likelihood then of that unimmunized person getting it goes down significantly because they're not coming in contact with somebody who's going to get it.
So do we think that then for the foreseeable future, the vaccine will continue to be manufactured in this way so that as far as we know, that's the best you're going to be able to do for people who have an allergy to eggs?
That's all that I'm currently aware of, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Other questions? Welcome. I think we get another caller here lined up. This caller, I believe, is in Urbana. We'll talk with them. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is a question about arthritis, pain relievers. Everybody mentions aspirin and ibuprofen and then the COX-2 inhibitors. I've been using naproxen, and I wonder if you could compare naproxen and ibuprofen. I mean, why is it that nobody ever mentions naproxen?
Actually, it's a perfectly good anti-inflammatory agent, and this is one of the situations where I think it's probably helpful to make people aware of the fact that when it comes to the anti-inflammatory agents, there is no one medication that's better or stronger than any other medication. But there are at least 6 or 7 different chemical classes of anti-inflammatory agents, and different people respond differently to these different medications. So one individual may say, you know, I took ibuprofen and it didn't do anything for me. And the next person says, oh, I thought it was wonderful. It really helped. Well, that doesn't mean that the medication's any different. It simply means that the person's response to it is different. And this can be one of the frustrating things about dealing with medications and a given individual, because there really isn't any way to predict in advance who's going to respond best to which chemical class. So it really becomes an individual experiment to find out which medication works best for that particular person. And by works best, we mean they get the benefits of the medication and hopefully avoid the potential side effects.
Yeah.
But broadly speaking, the benefits and potential side effects for all of the anti-inflammatory agents are quite similar. Now, as we mentioned, there is a new class of medications referred to as COX inhibitors. They are not necessarily better anti-inflammatory agents, but they do have, on a statistical basis, a slightly lower risk of gastrointestinal side effects. But it's not eliminated with that class, for sure, but it is lower than it is for some of the other anti-inflammatory agents. But naproxen is a fine anti-inflammatory agent. It's no better or no worse than any of the others.
Yeah, I have another sort of related question. I take also a low-dose aspirin once a day, which I've done for many years, and I'm wondering, I take sort of one naproxen every morning, and then I take this low-dose aspirin in the evening or before bedtime. Does naproxen have similar effects to the aspirin as far as the prevention of stroke and that sort of thing?
You're taking the low dose aspirin for cardiac reasons.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, and that has been recently studied, and interestingly enough, they found that the very low dose, as in a children's aspirin, is probably about all that's necessary to get the cardioprotective effects of aspirin, so you don't really need to use adult aspirin or large quantities of aspirin. Those studies for aspirin have just recently been completed. The question is whether other anti-inflammatory agents could do the same thing, and the answer is I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much.
All right, thank you. One thing I thought I might ask you quick, and we maybe have a couple minutes left just because it's been the news lately, is the possibility that for colonoscopy, we might move to what has, in terms of the stories that I've seen, been called a virtual colonoscopy. And apparently there's been some experimentation on using the CT scan to do it, and that has some advantages over the method that involves people having to be sedated and the tube going in there and going all around. It's apparently, well, at least you don't have to sedate people, or, you know, maybe I got this all wrong. Maybe you could talk about, do you think that that's a better procedure? And do you think that's going to be an option that more people are going to have?
It's, currently still, essentially investigational. But there are centers in the United States who initially tried 2D CT scans and didn't get quite the results that they want. But what you're referring to now are three-dimensional CT scans that essentially recreate an image of the inside lining of the colon. Mm-hmm. And the most recent studies have basically said that this probably can be, again, you know, it requires somebody very familiar with the technology, it has to be done correctly, can be as good as a screening colonoscopy. And so, yes, there probably is in the future, if this gets refined, the possibility that for perhaps routine screening, it may be done as an X-ray. You need the same prep.
Yeah, that's that part you still got to do.
That part you still got to do, and many people find the prep to be the worst part, because they're awake for that. For your colonoscopy, you're usually sedated. But the one drawback, potentially, now if you have the X-ray virtual colonoscopy, as they say, and it's negative, you're done. That's fine. But if you have a polyp,
Then
they're going to have to go do the colonoscopy anyway and remove it. So some people are going to start to say, well, you know, if I'm going to have both done anyway, why don't I just do the colonoscopy first? And there's going to be some questions about that. The procedure colonoscopy in rare instances can be associated with perforation of the colon.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is some potential downside to that. And until large enough populations get screened with the X-ray procedure, and we see how that all goes, it may be, you know, not definitive as to which way you should have it done. But it's certainly something to look forward to in the future.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
Jeff Swearingen, family practice physician from Carl Clinic. He's here on the program every other month for the show. We call Dr. the Family Doctor.